Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today we're speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is July 14th, 2011. Thank you to all of our listeners and friends. We appreciate when you comment and get on the live chat, and I'm going to go right over there and check to see whether I've opened the chat today. The reason I say that is my computer totally shut down, and I had to restart it about 2 seconds before the show went on the air today. And I am opening the chat now for anybody who is listening and wants to get involved in commenting. And I will also check Alan is here with us. Okay, so there are very convenient buttons right on the Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community website where you can comment, share this channel with any of your Facebook friends, and if you're on Twitter, to retweet. We've helped people make many connections to each other and to Alan for legal assistance. We want to empower people when they are making important life decisions. And this show helps people find direction and guidance in understanding their personal rights and freedoms in America and their options when dealing with vaccinations in the United States, no matter what state they reside in, because each state does have a little bit different rules and regulations. We provide many resource links and information that expands out beyond simply the vaccination issues. So once you get involved with learning the legalities and the laws and a little bit about the Constitution, then you begin to question a lot about how you're living and what's going on in the world. For those who are new to the Blog Talk Radio, you will find the chat right below the announcement page on the internet. And if you would like to be on the show sometime in the future, please contact us directly. Let us know your identity and the topic of interest. You may download the archive shows to your computer, iTunes, iPod, cell phone, or other mobile device for convenient listening. And if you would like to be a sponsor of our show, please contact us directly by friending the show and sending a message. And I'm going to welcome Alan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Debbie. How are you?
I'm doing great. I would like to introduce you again, as we normally do at the beginning of the show, that you are one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. I'm so thrilled that you live right in my backyard here and are doing wonderful advocacy work, because you advise many, many people and families, other attorneys who don't really know about vaccine exemptions and waivers. You assist groups and organizations throughout the United States on these issues and support many legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. You've published in many, many arenas, and you're on a number of radio shows, not just Blog Talk Radio, but Freedomizer Radio, Liberty News Radio, and on the television, and you're a member, an active member of many boards that deal with healing and health. So you're going to lead us into our most important news issues today, and then we're going to go ahead with questions and answers, the same as we did on the last show.
Oh, boy, that was a mouthful, Debbie. Thank you. Appreciate all of that.
Why did he give you a big intro today?
Yes, and I really appreciate that. You make me sound very busy, and I think I feel busy in more or less proportion to what you listed there. But I saw an article just this morning, as a matter of fact, that I thought I wanted to start off with today, because it's a little bit different than what we're normally talking about in the vaccine exemption and waiver arena. This concerns a lawsuit that was filed right here in Orange County, North Carolina, where I live, concerning a dog that was quarantined. And I thought this was interesting because this also relates to one of the fairly common questions that I get from people from time to time, which is, you know, is there any exemptions for pets or animals? But the case here appears to involve a dog. A woman heard her dog walking, went outside. The dog was barking at a raccoon under the porch, I think, or some equivalent to that. And the raccoon was clearly sick, and they got in animal control. And long story short, they didn't find any cuts or scratches or anything indicating a direct contact or fight between the dog and the raccoon. But the dog was about a month and a half late on its previous rabies shot. So they decided to quarantine the dog just to be safe. Now, that's whether any of us likes that or not, I think as far as that goes, it's understandable. Where it got curious and a little more of a concern for me was that they tested the dog, and the dog had titers for rabies, but there was at least one medical opinion that since they were past the scheduled date of the vaccine, they don't know whether the titers there are from a prior vaccine or possibly in reaction to a very recent exposure to rabies. Now, quarantine for humans, the most common issue that I see where that comes up is with chicken pox. And people who are exercising exemptions for their children in school, if some child in the classroom or potentially, I think, even in the school gets the chicken pox, then the unvaccinated exempt children have to stay home, and the incubation period for chicken pox is considered to be up to 21 days. And so kids are essentially kicked out of school for 21 days. But the quarantine period for dogs with rabies, and this is something I wasn't aware of before reading this article this morning, is apparently on the order of 4 to 6 months. They're going to keep this dog for 6 months. The woman is visiting her captive dog.
Really?
But when dogs are put in captivity, that's not the right word I'm looking for, when they're quarantined, and of course it's in a small space, controlled space, for for an extended period of time, this can have a significant effect on the dog's behavior, and there's a reference in the article from a medical authority, a veterinarian, saying that that behavior can even become permanent. So it's not even just the question of the woman not having possession of her dog for several months, which, of course, in dog years is some period of years, but that the dog could actually suffer permanent behavioral harm or damage. And so it's a difficult issue. She's not actually suing for the cost, which was going to be something on the order of $4,000, I think, for this 6 months of quarantine. She actually isn't even suing for the cost. It's that she wants to do the quarantine in her home. And,
right.
And that's sort of an interesting issue because
right.
You can understand how authorities, thinking of the dog as an animal, of course, it's a member of her family. Pets are members of family, and they're anything but... they're everything but another human being in the house when it's your pet. I mean, people treat pets like their children and so forth. And they feel about them similarly. And so to her, it's a member of the family that's been taken away. Of course, from authorities, it's an animal that is whose behavior is not going to be controllable by authorities from the outside of someone's home. So I'm not so much asserting a viewpoint or position on the case because I've just learned about it, but I thought it was an interesting article because it brought to light some very interesting issues that I hadn't been familiar with previously, quarantine time for rabies, for example, and raises, mm-hmm. of course, at least in by analogy, of pets to humans raises some of these legal boundaries and moral and ethical boundary questions. And let me dovetail, if I may, from that right into one of these common questions when people say, well, are there exemptions for dogs, which is a different, or pets, which is a different question than this quarantine issue. But this is one of the few fairly short answer questions in exemptions and waivers, and I don't like the answer. But the truth is that animals really, under the law, are regarded as property. And, of course, pets don't have philosophical or religious beliefs. And so the short story is I've never heard of a law anywhere in the U.S. or anywhere else for that matter that provides an exception of any kind, exemption or waiver, for vaccines for animals. Now, veterinarians and people in the alternative vaccine arena who are otherwise concerned about animals and pets will tell you that there are the same safety and health issues raised regarding vaccines and animals as there are with vaccines in humans. So while I can really follow quickly and clearly the logic of the argument that says, you know, your dog doesn't have philosophical or religious beliefs and therefore the dog can't be exempt, I'm still not quite sold on that in the sense that, well, you know, my newborn baby doesn't have philosophical or religious beliefs either, but I can exempt that child from the hepatitis B vaccine that they normally give in the hospital right after birth and any vaccines subsequent to that. So,
well, the difference there is that they consider the pet a piece of property and not, I don't know, what is the term that you use for a full-fledged human who has life determination and thought processes, logic. And so because the parent is the guardian of that child, of that infant, newborn, therefore the philosophical beliefs of the parent is really what is being used for the determination of whether or not that baby will get a vaccination. But I'm very, very looking at this transference of whether the quarantine issue. I went back to that again.
No, that's
no,
fine. That's fine.
I went back to that because that was one of the main concerns that we've always had, is that if there is an epidemic, influenza or any other type of epidemic going on, then what do we do about quarantine, and will we have to be taken out of our home forcefully? And in the same light, why can't they let the pet stay in the woman's home?
Well, I think it has to do with the dog potentially posing a risk to the owner or family members, that mm-hmm. from the perspective of the health authority outside of the home, whose job is to be better safe than sorry, you know, they're going to err on the side of caution as they see it.
I see.
And, you know, an owner may be perfectly confident that their animal, that they will be able to recognize when the animal is showing signs of illness, if that occurs. Authorities aren't so sure. They say the signs of illness are maybe difficult for some people to recognize, and, you know, it might be that it seems unlikely in this case because there was no evidence of bite or scratch or anything like that, which would normally be or typically be needed, I think, for infection to be transferred. But they're just being safe. The problem, and again, I don't have a clear position myself on this, though I tend to be sympathetic to the owner, that they're trying to be, you know, again, better safe than sorry. The odds are pretty good here that the dog did not get infected. But to make sure about that, it's sort of ironic because if she hadn't been a month and a half late on the rabies shot, she probably would have the dog at home.
Yeah, and there we don't know whether there was any contact between the rabid raccoon under her house and the dog itself. The dog may never have really come into contact. The dog was only barking at the raccoon that was under the house. So there's no absolute evidence that the dog...
Right.
Yeah.
And so, the question there is, could there nonetheless have been a transference? You know, could the raccoon have spit on the dog's nose or something? I mean, I don't know exactly what's required to become infected with rabies, but apparently, from the point of view at least of the animal control folks, that they felt that the combination of late on the rabies vaccine and proximity with the raccoon was enough for them to say, we're going to quarantine the dog. Now, the woman has challenged this in court, so we, you know, presumably she wouldn't do that unless there was at least some basis for making an argument that she could potentially win. So, in this case, the literal jury is still out on this one. We'll see. I think they said the case is going to be heard sometime this week or next week. And, you know, if I get any follow-up, I'll bring that up on the next show, though. It'll be interesting to see what happens with it.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of exemptions, you know, the no philosophical or religious exemptions for animals, okay, I can follow that logic, you know, mostly. But shouldn't there be potentially medical exemptions for animals? Because
right.
animals are susceptible to and do have adverse reactions to vaccines. And there was actually a bill in California in recent months that if it had passed, and I believe it did not, but if it had passed, would have created a medical exemption for dogs. Now, I'm not sure why dogs only as opposed to dogs and cats or, you know, other animals or pets. But anyway, I was quite surprised, pleasantly surprised, but quite surprised to see movement in that arena. I think that's a reasonable thing to ask for, and because there are the same kinds of problems in terms of adverse reactions with pets. If an animal has clearly an adverse reaction, that would certainly be a reason for an owner to say, gee, I don't want to get any more shots. Now, maybe there should be conditions on that the animal be required to be either indoors or on a leash at all times or within a pen or fence or something, you know, something to help reassure authorities and other citizens that the animal is reasonably kept, you know, reasonable steps taken to keep the animal from coming into contact, let's say, with a, you know, a rabid raccoon or whatever. But because that's one of the differences, I think, between pets and humans is that probably most pets are not professionally trained, and a sick animal, a sick pet, might not respond even if it was properly trained. So there's some reasonable basis for concern that that pets may not be as controllable as,
mm-hmm.
Well, I tell you, I start to say children, and then I have to ask, well, maybe they're really not all that different. But there are some children that are not controllable either. Anyway, there is a difference in our ability to control humans and animals, or at least some might argue that position. But it's,
mm-hmm.
I think more than anything else, just wanted to point out the animals are property under the law distinction and raise the issue for further and future discussion, Debbie,
okay,
appropriate
if people
comes
have,
up to,
yeah.
you know, issues about pets and vaccines, because there is a parallel controversy there, as there is with the concern about vaccines in humans.
Well, I have something from, it's a year ago, but there's a rabies challenge fund in New Mexico, the Rabies Medical Exemption Action Alert. The New Mexico pet owners launched an effort to raise a rabies medical exemption clause inserted into their rabies code. And there's a letter on the internet, I can get you that link for it, where they want you to contact a legislator and ask them to file a rabies medical exemption bill. And that was in July, about 1 year ago, July 23rd, 2010, for Albuquerque, New Mexico, that they were sending this. I don't know. So here it says, the states of Albany, Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Vermont, Virginia, and Wisconsin all have medical exemption clauses for sick animals in their rabies laws. And a bill is currently pending in the California legislature, which you talked about, to include a waiver in its statutes. So there we have some information for folks out there who don't know. The labels on rabies vaccines state that they are for the vaccination of healthy cats and dogs. and there are medical conditions for which vaccination can jeopardize the life or well-being of an animal. Passage of a medical exemption clause would allow New Mexico's veterinarians to write waivers for animals such as those who have anaphylactic reactions to vaccination or suffer from cancer, kidney, liver failure, hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, grand mal seizures, and chronic autoimmune disorders. Well, obviously, all of those types of symptom disease pictures can be exacerbated by vaccinations, which is what they're exactly saying. And the state of Maine inserted the following medical exemption into their three-year rabies protocol. It's called 7 MRSA Section 3922-3. It became effective in April 2005. So a letter of exemption from vaccination may be submitted for licensure if a medical reason exists that precludes the vaccination of the dog. And you're right. The question, why is it only a dog? Qualifying letters must be in the form of a written statement signed by a licensed veterinarian that includes a description of the dog and the medical reason that precludes vaccination. If the medical reason is temporary, the letter shall indicate a time of expiration of the exemption. And this goes on even further, but I think, you know, this gives us a lot more information than we had before regarding what's out there.
Well, that's great news, Debbie. Thank you. Please send me that link, and I'll add information on that to my site. So where I
okay.
address that question, I haven't researched that point, so I wasn't aware of those laws. Thank you.
Okay. So are we going to continue to talk about pets? Or are we going to do more questions? Or you have another bit of news to impart today?
Well, I tell you what. Let's see if we can skip quickly across just some very quick highlights on some other news items. I dug a little deeper into that one just because it's such a common question that I see. Not all the time, but periodically it comes up. And mm-hmm. so that's I'm delighted to have been brought up to speed on that with that information. Thank you, Debbie. The meningitis vaccine is under debate right now because they want to recommend this for very, very young children. I don't know if I have the specific age here. I think they're talking infants, though. And mm-hmm. I read a report recently from the Seattle Times. They just had a discussion that was open, CDC folks, but open to the public, and they had people there on both sides of the issue, people who were either damaged or had known someone who had been killed by meningitis, and then on the other side of the fence, people who were there who had suffered injuries or had lost a child, at least in one case, from vaccines. And so it's a really thorny issue. And one aspect of that came up that I was not aware of, the CDC, first of all, the CDC is a federal agency. They don't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents. But they do make recommendations. And when they make recommendations, far more often than not, the states will then individually enact the recommendations into law, and that becomes a mandate. And effectively removes choice to a large extent, if not absolutely, for some people in some states. Well, apparently, if my understanding and if the information is correct, when parents demand the vaccine, when they want to have the vaccine, in order for that to be covered by insurance, in order for it to be in demand so that it's cost-effective to produce, and probably other factors as well, the CDC is looking at that they have to recommend it, or a lot of people who want the vaccine wouldn't be able to get it. And so the recommendation, the cynical among us in the alternative vaccine community see recommendation as a step influenced by, if not deliberately, for the purpose of favoring the pharmaceutical industry. And I'm sure there's an element of that. But there's also apparently some practical concerns. You know, they either recommend it or it's not going to be available to everybody who wants it. But if they do recommend it, then it becomes, for practical purposes, you know, mandatory. And, mm-hmm. of course, doctors will recommend it if it becomes recommended, and then people are acting on the doctor's recommendation and not necessarily doing their own independent investigation to make an informed choice about whether or not, and many people don't even know there are exemption options at all, let alone get to a point where they're seriously considering them and looking what it takes to qualify in any given state or situation. So it's a legitimately controversial issue, because meningitis is not like the chicken pox, where you get chicken pox, you're going to be sick, you're going to have bumps, but you get better. Meningitis can injure and kill, can cause brain damage. People can lose limbs with meningitis. Now, there are separate questions that I think aren't being asked here, which is, well, what predisposes someone to getting meningitis or to having a severe case of it? Because not everybody exposed to a disease comes down with it. I read something recently, I think it was from Mercola.com, Dr. Mercola, talking about the majority of the strains of meningitis that one could catch the majority of cases involve a strain that aren't even addressed by the vaccine. Even if you go by statistics of adverse events from vaccines generally, and of course the vast majority of vaccine adverse events are never even reported, but even if you just go by what is reported, it doesn't quite add up that if everybody is, or virtually everyone is vaccinated against meningitis, the adverse events from the vaccines, even just going by the reported adverse events, will outnumber the deaths from the disease. And so mathematically, it really doesn't add up. But in this particular article about this particular very recent meeting in Washington State, they said something like 53% of the people at the end of it voted to add the vaccine, and 31% voted against recommending routine use. And then there was something like 16% who voted against recommending or paying for it for poor children. So it's there are some legitimate aspects to the controversy on both sides. You know, people who are suffering from the disease or have lost someone from the disease certainly want to believe that there's something you can do to prevent that. But as to whether it really works or whether the adverse events from the vaccines are even worse is a separate question.
Well, it is very complicated. And a news article about meningitis vaccine, as this debate continues just this week on the CDC forum, because there is a something going on with, let me see where I have that information. I guess it's dealing with the, here it is, Novartis falsely implied that its Menveo, M-E-N-V-E-O meningitis vaccine was approved in a manner consistent with guidelines from an influential United States advisory group, health regulators said in a letter to the Swiss drug maker. And what they're saying is the U.S. FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, in a letter from just this June 24th, said that they were doing some false and misleading promotional materials implying that the FDA approved the use of the Menveo vaccine. And a panel of federal vaccine experts advises the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that they were making this claim that their vaccine was approved and advised to have it. The FDA requested to Novartis to immediately stop to use these promotional materials, and the company spokeswoman said that the vaccine unit already stopped doing that, and that's like only two weeks old. They took the communication very seriously, Novartis did, and stopped to. But once you get this information, it's like opening a Pandora's box. Once you get information out, how do you put it back in the box?
Yeah, how do you unring the bell? You can't.
Yeah.
And
that's just one of the issues. Yeah, the FDA accepted Novartis's application to broaden the use of Menveo in infants and toddlers from 2 months of age. The vaccine, which protects against the strains of meningococcal disease, which is meningitis, that they say it causes potentially deadly meningitis, which is true, is approved in the United States for people aged 2 to 55 years old. They have three types of meningitis vaccines, by the way. And here's the clincher. This is the thing. I wanted to do like a little blog about this. The last line of this article says, Novartis has three types of meningitis vaccines, and it is optimistic that its meningitis franchise will be a blockbuster. The company is also hoping its meningitis franchise will help the unit reduce its dependency on sales from pandemic vaccines. Now, it sounds like it's a movie theater, and they're selling, you know, a McDonald's franchise. That I don't know if you can grasp the lingo that they're using, the vernacular of making these commonplace storefronts. I don't know. What am I thinking here?
Well, it goes to the larger issue, as I hear what you're saying. Well, many different issues that raise there potentially, but the specific there about misrepresenting a product goes to a larger issue having to do with the status quo for the way the pharmaceutical industry does business generally. The pharmaceutical industry over the last 20 years has averaged about $1 billion a year in criminal and civil fines, and most of those are for improper marketing of their products.
Oh.
And Pfizer, I know I've mentioned this once before, but Pfizer, if not many times, Pfizer in 2009 had a $1 billion criminal fine and a $1.3 billion civil fine. And one of the reasons the criminal fine was as much as that was because this was the fourth time they'd been caught doing the same thing since 2002. Now, I read another article recently suggesting that when the pharmaceutical companies get fined, they add that onto the cost of their products, and so they're not really paying a fine ultimately. And the suggestion was made, and it certainly looks like it to me, this is not just one company, and it's not just once or twice every couple or few years. This just goes on every year, continually for decades. And in recent years, it's been on the order of many times, hundreds of millions of dollars is not at all unusual for these fines. And many, many different companies have been hit with these fines. So it seems to be the status quo. This is how the industry does business. And obviously, it is a net gain for them to market their products in this way, to conduct business this way, or they wouldn't keep doing it year after year after year after year. And it's gotten worse in the last few years.
What do you think pushed it over the edge to say that the last 2-3 years they have made this their modus operandi of how they actually do business? What changed in the environment, or either the pharmaceutical environment or the economic environment or public health environment? What are the factors that contributed to their behavior in that way?
Well, I don't have any. It's a excellent question. I don't have any information on specifics on that. And to even get to a place where, for many of us, to wrap our minds around the idea that an industry could behave, or even an individual company, let alone an entire industry, could routinely behave in engage in criminal behavior, to get over what for most of us would be an enormous moral and ethical hurdle to where one could routinely engage in behavior like that is just a challenge. But once they get over that hurdle, by reasonable inference at least, I think we have to assume that they're looking at numbers, that they're a for-profit business, and they're looking at how can they make the most money. And if crossing moral and ethical and even legal or even criminal boundaries results in a net profit, apparently they're going to keep doing it. You know, again, it wasn't something that one psychotic executive did, you know, who didn't have the mental capacity to have compassion for the people who are going to suffer or even die as a result of that. And to the best of my knowledge, few, if any, pharmaceutical executives serve any time for the crimes of their companies. Now, there was an article recently suggesting that there was going to be some effort made to target individuals now for prosecution.
Right.
And there was actually a test case. So maybe this, you know, if that is successful, if they really start looking at individuals, because once some of these people start serving time, that'll change, I would expect anyway, make a radical change in business. Will they look for some way to continue improper behavior in a more defensible way or covertly in some way that they're less likely to get caught or get away on a technicality or so forth? Well, of course they will. They've done routinely engaged in criminal behavior up to this point. They're not going to stop doing that. They're just going to look for how can they keep doing it or where can they do it and get away with it. But I don't think you're going to change people's moral constitution by locking them up.
Well,
you're just going to cause them to look harder.
I personally feel that this is human nature. It is within the potential of each and every human being to act in this way, and there are, just like in government, there's supposed to be checks and balances which have been lost. So within our own internal structure, we may have lost some checks and balances. Maybe these checks and balances must need to be imposed externally, just like a child growing up. They need to have their parent telling them what is right from wrong, and until that is inculcated into the nature of that child as they grow and develop. But we always have that potential to do wrong, to do what is tempting or unethical or immoral. And we really need to take a closer look at our own selves. You know, I don't want to make a judgment on anybody else, but only look at my own self of when I make a choice of what I'm going to do in this life. And I just think in general, this is a lesson in human nature, and perhaps what the governments or the supervising agencies need to do is find the ways to get ourselves back in checks and balances.
Well, I agree with you absolutely on that. You know, I think we're all susceptible to I think it works on both ends. I think we're all susceptible to things that many of us would never think we would do, but who knows what we might do given the right environment, circumstances, and influences.
Exactly.
And so forth. But I think human potential is on the opposite end. The potential for us to do extraordinary things is equally available, and most
yes.
of us never reach that either. So let's I just wanted to sort of throw that in to kind of balance the concept there. But you're right, we need to take a stricter approach to this. It may be that some of the laws are already there, they just haven't been enforced. You know, somebody on a Facebook page made a potent comment recently when I was making assertions about law, and one of the responses was, but there's law, then there's what people, and I'm paraphrasing horribly, but the concept was, there's law, but then there's what people actually do, the way things really work. And one of the enormous, you know, we may have a lot or most of what we need already in place in terms of the law and the structure of the law for many of these kinds of issues, but are they being enforced as a practical matter? How easy is it or not to enforce them? Just because the law says you're not supposed to do something, you know, that alone, of course, doesn't keep somebody from doing what they're not supposed to do. So it's an inherently complex
kids will be kids also, and they're going to test the limits. They're going to push you. How late can I stay up? What show can I watch? What movie am I allowed? What drugs am I allowed to take? So, you know, there's going to be those rebels and in every walk of life. Did you want to talk about any further news items, or do you want to go into the last about less than 20 minutes left?
I keep thinking we can skim over the news issues quickly, and each one turns into a deep philosophical conversation, and maybe I just need to let go of my attachment to the idea of short news.
Well,
I think
as we answer, as we touch upon each of our news items, we are answering many of the questions that people typically have and that are in your questions and answers area.
I agree. But I did want to, again, at least touch on briefly if I could, and if it ends up not being brief, that's okay with me, Debbie. But there's a constant flow, if not flood at times, of information on this issue. And so I really want to take advantage of the opportunity to, you know, at least mention, if not also discuss some of these. There was a case in Malawi, a country in Southeast Africa, recently where 131 children were vaccinated at gunpoint in the Nsanji district there. And I don't know that there's a lot to say about that other than and maybe brief discussion about, I mean, the story there from the article I read seems to be the sort of thing you might expect from that kind of a title. And the bottom line is, the officials there, there was a number of people who had not wanted to be vaccinated and had actually left the country over into Mozambique, and they came back to Malawi, and officials learned that they were back, and so it was, okay, this time you're not getting away, and the health official brought the police with them and forcefully, under gunpoint, vaccinated the kids. Well, surely the people who are administering the vaccines feel that it's necessary, and the unvaccinated children were a threat and risk to themselves and everyone else, you know, as is promoted about vaccines generally. You know, my first gut reaction, and frankly I think it was somewhat naive reaction was, well, you know, it's a shame in third world countries that there's still, you know, that kind of thing would be possible, but it's not really possible here. But, you know, we saw something not too far away from that when we had parents in Maryland a year or two ago who were being threatened with jail if they didn't vaccinate their kids. We have a situation, of course, as we've talked from time to time here on this show, about how most states have laws that if the state declares an emergency, that they can mandate emergency vaccines and throw exemptions out the window. I don't think we're likely to see people forced to vaccinate at gunpoint. But I want to mention on this point, there's an aspect of this that we on this side of the issue don't think about much. And it came up for me when I was sitting down with my North Carolina State Senator and the State Public Health Director a few months ago, and we were there talking about from a position of wanting, at that particular moment, about wanting to get clarification that the vaccine exemptions that we already have in North Carolina for routine immunizations would also apply in the emergency context. And it turns out, to our pleasant surprise, that the state policy is that they do. It just really wasn't clear in the law. So we're working on trying to get legislation through that will clarify that point. But the health director's counsel brought up an interesting point, and he said, well, we're not concerned in an emergency about people trying to get away from vaccines. We're concerned about the people who are going to be clawing each other, and I'm paraphrasing again horribly, but clawing each other to death to get to the vaccines.
Right.
And that's not something that, you know, at least for myself on my side of the issue, do they think of very often. So what that, but that occurs with under the all the hype about the pandemic, people who aren't aware of the vaccine controversy were scrambling to get vaccines. People were in lined up, you know, for blocks, waiting for hours in some parts of the country trying to get their swine flu vaccine. And this raises a really interesting question, because we can speculate all day about what we think people will do, and we can look at what the law says, but you put people in a situation where they are genuinely scared and panicking, feel threatened for their lives. You know, God forbid if we had a real pandemic that was a virulent strain of flu or whatever it was, and people really were dying in, of course, any death is tragic, even by the seasonal flu, but with the swine flu, there was even fewer deaths from that than there was the seasonal flu. But if we had something that was causing that really was a genuine threat.
Right,
to
like
the general
population. if we had the black plague or something, because you know you never know with the way that viruses and bacterias are mutating and rapidly growing, anything could trigger something.
Can I imagine that a health official would be knocking on my door and have with him a policeman under, you know, a more threatening situation? Absolutely. I mean, would the policeman pull his gun and point it at me? I certainly hope not. But I can imagine. It's not hard for me at all to imagine that if the threat were severe enough, whether it was even a real threat or not, and now we know from the swine flu pandemic that fake threats can be presented in a way that they are responded to as though they are real, both in terms of the general public perception and the actions of authorities. There were 11 states that declared emergencies for swine flu. We now know there was no emergency. And Obama declared a national emergency. There was no emergency. That was all complete hype and blown out of proportion. But states took actions, and New York even did temporarily mandate swine flu vaccines for healthcare employees in response to that. So, you know, whether the threat is ultimately real or not, if there is a declared threat and a perceived threat, you know, could we see somebody pulling guns, either an official or even a scared neighbor who says, "You get that damn vaccine, I don't want you getting me and my kids sick." You know, who knows
right.
what people would do. You
so
know,
you're really imagining this vigilante world out here.
Well, I had someone on the phone tell me once during the swine flu pandemic. He said, "Alan, if you don't go out and get yourself a gun and stick it in the nose of anybody who comes to your door, I don't even want to talk to you." I said, "Thank you very much," and I hung up the phone. But the point is there are people out there who have that position. Now, this was somebody who was anti-vaccine and saying how he was going to respond to somebody who's going to try to force a vaccine. We did have one report coming out of West Virginia where a high school student was physically held down against his will and vaccinated with a swine flu vaccine. I'm not sure that that's lawful.
No,
I'm not sure
it can't be. There's no way.
Well, I don't think that specific issue has ever been tested in the courts. So I don't know if we have an answer to the question. But
what happened to that high school student? Do we recall? Whether
I had no further information. I did not ever hear that they filed a lawsuit, and my guess is they didn't. You know, you got the vaccine, it's over. You can't undo that. But as to whether or not he had some fundamental constitutional or other state law rights violated, I'm unclear.
Let me make a plug for homeopathy. you gave me a leeway there. You know, you just said somebody can be vaccinated and you can't take it back. Well, we can't really take it back, but we know that certain individuals are going to be very sensitive to the ingredients within that vaccine. And homeopathically, we can take a look at what those the person's symptoms are, what they exhibit. And there are 5 to 10 typically homeopathic remedies dealing with that. You can take off immediately. Thuja, Occidentalis, and Silica are the top two that are typically used. And Tina Smith, a very famous homeopath, has a whole protocol of what to do that he used in many, many hundreds of children. So, you know, we don't want to tell people it's going to be hopeless if something happens, but we want to let them know that there are other things, and probably nutritional things to help clear the body of these toxins. Now, you can go on. I took a detour.
No, thank you. That's important information. I think people have used the phrase in regards to treating vaccines or vaccine adverse effects as antidoting vaccines. Is that a correct phrase here, or could you clarify what that means with regard to homeopathy?
I wouldn't say that it's antidoting. I would say that what homeopathy does is it only assists the body in building its own immune system in responding. So we have to look at the individual, because one person can have a reaction of hives, another person could have asthma, another person could have headaches, and you just basically take the symptoms that are being exhibited and deal with it as you would any kind of an illness, or a physical, mental, emotional disorder that a human being has that takes them off of their normal state of well-being. And that's the only way that true homeopathy is practiced. So I would call it that.
It may be that as I'm thinking about this again, that phrase or word was used in reference to remedies that are made from the vaccine itself.
Right, that would be more isopathic.
Okay. But that is one potential way of addressing homeopathically, that you would make a remedy actually from the vaccine.
Right.
Itself.
So there are a number of people out there in the field who practice some of this type of medical intervention where they will take it's very much like a vaccination against a vaccination, where you're taking a small, very, very small amount, a homeopathically potentized amount of the substance, and then giving it back to the individual who recognizes that energetic that substance, and then will start to clear it. So I think that, or respond to it in a healing way, because there's a certain principles in homeopathy, certain laws, universal laws, that two of the same disease cannot exist in one body at the same time. So if you're going to give an energy of that substance, that vaccine material matter, in a energetic form, then that vaccine can't really continue to live in the same body. So I would say this is really isopathy, not homeopathy. Isopathy is taking the substance and making a remedy from it, where homeopathy, you are using something similar. So if you're using Thuja, it's a plant. It's a conifer plant, and you're using that energy to clear the illness. Or if you're using silica, it's a mineral that you're using to clear the symptoms that the person is exhibiting. And there are many, probably hundreds and hundreds of different remedies for these types of symptoms. Does that clarify the difference between isopathy and homeopathy?
It certainly helps. This is so fascinating, Debbie, because there's so much out there to do. I'm going to, if I may, sort of just a quick generalization here and say the bottom line is, if you're in a situation where you can't avoid being vaccinated, there are things that you can do after vaccination, before and after vaccination, to help minimize the chance of and severity of adverse reactions. And give Debbie a call if you're in that situation.
and I'll tell you who to contact.
Yeah, and I've got some folks listed on my website as well. I've got some information about that concept, generally, if you must vaccinate.
I want to say the best form of prevention is, one, knowledge. Get the information about what you're putting into your body. Number two, do all this good lifestyle things that you can, sleep, nutrition, exercise, sunlight, those general things. That's your boosting your own immune system. That is the best way to prevent illness. But we're all going to be susceptible to one thing or another.
Well, and the sad reality is that with vaccines, many people are, most people potentially have an exemption they can exercise, but not everybody. There are some people in some situations. And I'll tell you, just real quick, the one category where this comes up the most is college students and healthcare programs, where they have to do clinical work in local hospitals, because there you're dealing with immunizations required by those local hospitals and not with state law, and so your state law exemption doesn't help you there. I won't go into an explanation because it's a little bit complicated, and we've got just a couple minutes left here, but there are ways that many of those people in that situation can at least theoretically, legally avoid immunizations, but many can't. But again, bottom line is there are some people, so a lot of students in that situation find themselves ultimately in get the vaccines or quit the course of study. And there and in other arenas, there are situations, bottom line, where people are faced with a decision, get the vaccine or some other alternative in terms of what they lose by not doing the vaccine or what happens to them by not doing the vaccine that's not acceptable to them. So in those situations, it's good to know that if you have to get a vaccine, that there are some things you can do to give your body the best support in that situation that you can. But if I can push on here, I am going to actually at this point, because we're, gosh, Debbie, the time flies, but I'm going to just real briefly mention two or three things here in the news and refer folks to the PandemicResponseProject.com, Pandemic Response Project website, and that's PandemicResponseProject.com. There's a link in the upper right that says news, and all the most, if not all, the news items we've been talking about today and many, many others that there's just not time to talk about them all are listed there. And I would invite listeners to go to that site to skim the article. Sometimes you learn a lot just by looking at the titles, and, of course, any that you're interested in learning more about, you can click on the link and read the actual article. But we just recently had a vaccine injury case in the federal vaccine courts that awarded $61 million for a child injured by a vaccine. The short story there is there was just severe brain damage. Now, that's not compensation for the parents' misery. That's the money it's going to cost to take care of this child for the rest of her life. Money can never compensate anyone for the loss of a life or the loss of quality of life in the extreme way that that can happen and does happen with vaccines.
We don't have really, you know, either you want to talk longer about this.
Nope.
We can extend the show. I mean, this is, you brought up a whole basket full of stuff here. $61 million. That's an incredible number. Where did they pull that out of the hat? And you said that it affects not just this one child, it's the loss of her life as a regular person.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, this is the money that it's going to cost for this child to be cared for the rest of her life.
Is she on life support? What is?
I don't know that it's life support, but she has. Let me see if I can find it real here. I mean, she has a list. She, I know she has a seizure disorder. She has.
Right.
Let me see if I can find what they said she was left with. Cerebral palsy, cognitive delays, encephalopathy, seizure disorder. Just severe enough problems that she's obviously going to need close care.
Right.
You know, for the rest of her life, she's not going to ever.
She's brain damaged, basically, and we know that these vaccinations do affect the neurological system of the human, of the living organism. So, as we started the show with the pets and the dog, it's the same thing, that these vaccines have very powerful effects.
Do you want to spend a little time running over, Debbie, or?
Yeah, that's up to you. I mean, we can possibly do that.
Well, why don't we go ahead and do that a little bit then? And, of course, if anyone is typing in questions or comments, we're glad to take time to that. There's so much going on in this issue. It's just so hard to – no one can keep up with it all. But even skimming, as it were, the information as it goes by is really helpful for all of us to have at least general awareness of what's going on. It's truly an inherently complex and multifaceted issue, the larger vaccine controversy.
Okay. So what did you want to impart the last bit of information?
Well, there was an article from Infectious Disease News from earlier this month that made a reference to three new outbreaks of vaccine-derived polioviruses reported since late 2010. There, the article makes reference to several polio outbreaks where the outbreaks were found to be the vaccine-derived strains of the virus.
Right.
Curiously, but perhaps not surprisingly, the CDC's response to this is more vaccination. But You know, maybe there's a medically trained listener in our audience who could call or write in and explain to me how that makes sense. If it does, even within the mainstream view of vaccines, I don't quite follow the logic. The vaccine is causing outbreaks, so let's vaccinate more. But
they don't, you know, they don't know what else to do. They have.
It must be. It must be. But I guess the main point there, I just wanted to underscore that even current vaccines, you know, this is something we have known to have happened in the past, that vaccines either cause illness or in some cases even disease outbreaks, or in other cases we have outbreaks in highly or even fully vaccinated populations. I'm not in a position to say whether or not vaccines ever really do any good. I understand that sometimes when they appear to be successful or helpful, that they may actually only be suppressing symptoms rather than actually literally and in a more sort of clean and pure sense preventing the disease. I know there's something called atypical measles, which is something that is a more chronic and severe form of measles, and that is found in vaccinated children.
Mm-hmm. And only in vaccinated children.
Right, and it's believed by many to be a consequence of the vaccine. And one theory, and maybe you can elaborate some on this, Debbie, from the homeopathic perspective, but the theory about that, as I understand it, on a more superficial level, is that the vaccine is suppressing symptoms and actually pushing the disease, what wouldn't ordinarily be an acute disease with acute symptoms that comes and resolves after some period of time, is pushed inward in a way that it manifests in a more severe chronic form and not as common, and therefore it's not as readily diagnosed or diagnosable either, which is sort of a separate issue. But is that in any way consistent or fit within the homeopathic model of how disease works?
I am not knowledgeable about the specific what you're talking about, atypical mm-hmm. measles. It sounds to me as if there was a mutation in a resistant strain. That's what it sounds like, that the child is getting some sort of a resistant strain of that the vaccine has been manipulated. So, but that's only a hypothetical. I don't really have an answer for that.
Yeah, we know that the antibodies that are generated in response to a vaccine are not identical to the antibodies generated in response to the wild virus or bacterium,
right,
you know, with diseases. And that's sort of obvious when you consider that vaccines require boosters, and when people
right.
get the wild disease, they usually have immunity for life. And so,
I call it natural. You call it wild disease. I call it natural disease.
Natural. Thank you. That's a better word for it. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I see in some of the more scientific articles refer to the wild virus or something like that. I like natural better though.
Well, you also have to remember that the natural disease, you get it through the mucous membranes in a more natural way, whether it's communicable, meaning that it's either through the air, or somebody sneezes, or you were touching a glass that was drunk, or through blood, you know, but not the way a vaccination is given as an injection. That's totally unnatural. So the body has no true means of responding in a natural way to that. As far as I'm concerned,
right.
That's personal
right.
opinion.
Well, and I have read from medical folks that vaccines deal with only one aspect or one facet of a multifaceted immune system and immune response. By something being injected, yes, you can trigger the production of antibodies, but that's only one part of a larger total package that we have in our immune system. And so natural immunity is a more comprehensive or maybe holistic is an applicable term there, but it affects more of the total immune system. I'm speaking in very general layman's terms here because I don't know the medical terms off the top of my head. But the bottom line is the sort of concept there is that a natural immunity affects a larger portion of our immune system than vaccines do. So it's a less complete immunity from vaccines, which just sort of underscores, I think, the point you were just making.
Well, let me say this also. When we have a natural disease that we are sensitive to, it actually increases our immune system. It boosts our immune system, and we become stronger for the next assault. And because the body has now its own body wisdom, that it knows it's supposed to get a fever, and it knows it's supposed to have a cough to dispel these things, and it knows it's supposed to, how that individual unique person responds is their method of dealing with impositions on the body in a natural way. And so you will usually see, almost every parent can recognize, that when their child has had the chickenpox or the measles or influenza, typically afterwards they have a jump in their mental acuity and their ability to think and respond, even talking, or physically their dexterity and their physical ability to get around, walk, or whatever. You see that jump occur after a disease of this nature. Whereas on the other side, with a vaccinated individual, the person's actually going to get weaker.
Yes, and I hear anecdotal stories supporting both sides of that, that the idea that in childhood infectious diseases, most of them, are actually developmental milestones, not just a temporary inconvenience because a child
right.
is sick and somebody has to care for them. And to the contrary,
right.
I've heard reports of people saying that after being vaccinated, even aside from the obvious serious adverse reactions, but on a more subtle level, people report the children, I know one description was the child just lost his spark, you know, just sort of, it's just in the light dimmed, so to speak.
Right.
Was not the same vibrant,
bouncy.
Yeah,
you turned off that switch in them that is their own innate, natural, vital force ability to respond to whatever's happening around them. And
but it has
said,
more to do than just whether you're healthy or not. It has to do with it permeates and affects all facets of the being in one way or another, directly or indirectly, I think is the underlying concept there. And I just really want to endorse that one a lot. It's a broader issue than just whether or not you're sick with little bumps from the chicken pox or measles or not.
Okay. We're going to pick up next Thursday at noon with our continuing current events discussions and letting people know what is happening in their area, in their state, or that will affect so many of us as we move forward with the vaccination issues. And I'm so grateful to have you, Alan, as our guide. Did you have anything else you wanted to tell them, or tell them to hold their breath until next Thursday?
Debbie, we could go for hours every Thursday, but let's go ahead and wrap this up and pick up where we left off today. There's always lots to talk about. We always welcome your questions about vaccine rights, whether it's exemptions and waivers or legislative issues or anything concerning your rights and vaccines. Let us know. We'll be glad to talk about it on the air.
Right. And this is all about awareness and legislative involvement. I want to remind everyone about your ebook, Alan, that provides the information for people in every situation who will need to make an informed decision about exemptions and waivers. This ebook will help you to determine whether or not you can get through the vaccination exemption maze on your own, or whether you will need an attorney to be your advocate. The most common questions regarding religious exemption issues and I guess your pet stuff. I don't know if that's going to be in there. Each state will have their own statutes and regulations, and therefore individuals must contact their state's agency that controls their laws. So go to the Homeopathy World Community, HWC, website, and on the right-hand column is a little yellow square that says click here for more information about Alan's ebook. And do that and get informed. We will see you the next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be young girl. One.